Terry Sweeney. I'm really happy. I'm still with my lover that I was with back then, who was a writer on the show. I went back to television writing and movie writing, and so I've made money and done well. So I'm really actually happy I had the experience. The training is invaluable, and I've used it, you know? I've just used it in everything I've ever done since then. Damon Wayans. I was brought back for the last show of the season. There's a sick side of Lorne Michaels. He loves the rebel. Once he got over his own ego, what I did on the show that time was basically a fuck-you move, he sat back and said, "Well, the guy's talented. I just don't think he's ready to be a prime-time player." It was great, except Dudley Moore was the host, and I was doing this joke about, I was born with a club foot, and so I used to do this whole routine about when I was young, how I used to wear orthopedic shoes, and I had a shoe with like a 5-inch heel, and I used to walk with a limp. And I did me walking with the limp, and said people that knew me thought I was cool. Thank God I was in the ghetto. I did this thing about how I wasn't a fighter at the time. I was just a very passive kid. And I said, "You don't find many handicapped bullies." And I did, you know. Imagine some crippled dude coming up to you. "Give me your lunch money." But Dudley Moore walked with a limp, too. When I started doing the guy walking with the limp, he walked over to Lorne and like, "You're not going to let him do it." So Lorne also killed that bit. But then at the end he let me do it. Dudley saw it at dress rehearsal. I was looking at Lorne like, "You know this is a live show and I'm going to do shit anyway." Dudley was just like, "I can't go on, my foot." I didn't do it to mess with Dudley. It was in my stand-up, a really funny bit I used to do. But it was his own insecurity. The reason I came out with the bit was the same reason, the feeling that people were watching. It was like, even if I don't do the joke, don't people look at that boot on your foot and go, "Damn, that's big." Bernie Brillstein. Brandon calls me up in April and says, "I'm going to cancel Saturday Night Live." And by then, I have to admit, I was happy to hear it. You know, rather than see it suffer. I wasn't in love with the persona of Saturday Night Live the way Lorne was. So I go home that night, and I said to my wife at the time, "Deb, they're going to cancel the show." She said, "You can't let them bring Lorne back and then cancel it." She got offended. And I said, "You know, sometimes you've got to hear it from someone else." I call Brandon back and said, "No way. You've got to give him one more year." Brandon said to have Lorne come out, which he did. We all met, and that's how it stayed on the air. It was that close, it was canceled. My wife knew nothing about show business, but she liked Lorne. She said, "You can't let them do that. Bring him back and then cancel him? That's terrible." And she was right. Common sense. Warren Littlefield, NBC executive. Brandon was very involved in getting feedback to Lorne on the show and felt that it was struggling. And I do remember him saying, "It's over." I think many of us would, in our years as executives at broadcast networks, be in a meeting, focus on problems, sometimes lose sight of what had been accomplished and what we had. And that kind of piling on happens, and you push away from the table and you go, "That's it, goddammit, we're shutting it down. I'll be the decision maker." And God bless Brandon. In the light of day, I think he woke up and went, "Oh, God, am I really going to face Lorne today and tell this human being, who I love and care about and believe in, that I'm pulling the plug on him and the show?" And that's when that cold executive maneuver that you said the day before, "I'm going to take control and take action," that's when you finally realize, you know what, maybe I'll just wait a little bit. And part of that is not wanting to be confrontative, and also in the light of day, forgetting the posturing for a moment, saying, "You know what? It may not be perfect. What is? But does that mean we throw it out? And what do we have to replace it with?" One of the questions you have to ask yourself is, "All right, kill it, but what's your plan?" And sometimes faced with "what's your plan?", you look at it in a different light. Robert Smigel. By the end of the season, the show was still a disaster. I had this idea to do a cliffhanger like Dallas, one of those obnoxious cliffhangers that really were new at the time, and I wrote one where Billy Martin sets the studio on fire and Lorne's in there and he runs out and he just saves Lovitz, which infuriated a few people in the cast. And he leaves all these other people, and it's like, who will survive? And then the whole credit crawl, everybody's name had a question mark after it. Once more, Saturday Night Live had teetered on the brink, and once more the program was spared the unseemly ignominy of cancellation. Now it was up to Lorne Michaels to reinvent the show one more time. And though he still disliked firing people, one of his first moves had to be to throw the new cast out and recruit a newer new cast, one that could help SNL win back America's heart. Michaels had learned the lesson of casting people for their talent rather than for their names, and he set about rebuilding the show in much the way he had first constructed it, he and his staff searching comedy clubs and improv groups for bright young performers, especially those who could write sketches and create characters. Even though the search would prove to be successful, Saturday Night Live still faced a future that was anything but certain. For the first time in its history, the show was renewed for only 13 weeks, not a full 20-week season. Brad Gray, manager.
I thought Dana Carvey was really special, and I wanted Lorne to see him. We all went to the Comedy Store, Bernie, myself, Cher, and Lorne. It turned out to be one of those silly circumstances where the moment Dana went on stage, Lorne had to go to the men's room. So I was sitting there, and I knew that Dana would just kill, which he did. And just as he was finishing, Lorne returned from the men's room. So Dana didn't get the show then. We waited until the next go-round.
Dana Carvey, cast member.
I'd auditioned twice before. This time I went on at midnight at the Comedy Store after Sam Kinison. I always had my own equivalency of the dumb blonde in my career, especially back then. I really looked like an innocent Midwestern guy with blonde bangs. I just didn't look like a comedian, and it kind of threw people sometimes. But this guy had a little club on the west side, and Lorne saw me there. Rosie O'Donnell was headlining, and she let me come in and do 40 minutes before her. And Lorne showed up with Brandon Tartikoff and Cher, just so we would be a little more nervous. And that's where I got the show. My wife didn't even move out to New York. I said, this will probably fail. I went out there early because Lorne said, you could come out and, you know, just hang. So I came out in August, and Lorne turns to me and says, Paul and Linda are coming over tonight. I said, excuse me? Oh, Paul McCartney, over here. And literally the blood drained from my face, and I went into a room that Lorne called Jack's Room, because it's where Nicholson would stay. And I called my friends back in the Bay Area and said, I'm going to meet Paul McCartney tonight. And Paul and Linda came over for 4 nights in a row, and we listened to demo tracks. We heard all about them. Being a Beatle fanatic, that experience was just absolutely mind-blowing.
Terry Turner, writer.
When I got onto the show, there was a sense that this show is over. I remember sitting in a restaurant with my father-in-law in New York, and he said, my son-in-law here works on Saturday night. And the waiter said, God, I thought that thing was off the air. It's been bad for so long.
Victoria Jackson, cast member. I lived in L.A., had my own house, and I had already been on a canceled series. I remember I was pregnant in 85 with my first baby. I was 26 years old. I was doing a commercial in the desert for a truck company, and I was nauseous and everything, and I didn't want them to know I was pregnant because they might fire me. But I wanted the money because I was the breadwinner since my husband never worked. And so I came back to L.A. from that commercial, and I heard someone say my name was on a list at the Improv to audition for Saturday Night Live, and why wasn't I there? And I was like, huh? Nobody told me about that. William Morris was my agent, but nobody told me that there was even an audition. Here's the cut to the chase. I had the baby. I did the pickup artist. And all of a sudden, the phone rings in the summer of 86, and my baby's 3 months old, and it was someone from Saturday Night Live, and they said, do you want to audition for Saturday Night Live tomorrow? And it didn't even go through my agent. It didn't go through anyone I knew. It was like they called my home directly. I have no idea how they got my phone number. It's really mysterious. And I said, oh, sure. And then they said, there'll be a plane ticket waiting for you at LAX tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to come to New York and audition. And they said to be sure and bring all your characters. And I said, okay. So I hung up. And I was like, I don't have any characters. I never was in the Groundlings, and I never took improv, and, you know, basically the way I got on Johnny Carson was I had a 6-minute stand-up comedy act that was mostly doing a handstand while reciting poetry. So I hung up the phone. I told my husband, I'm going to New York tomorrow to audition for SNL, and they said, bring your characters. And I looked at him, like, bewildered, you know? I knew about SNL and Belushi just because you know it as part of the culture, but when I grew up, we didn't have a TV. And then I was in college and I didn't have one, and then I was trying to get on TV, so I was always busy. So then I flew to New York. I brought my ukulele and my handstand. The handstand traveled with me. And I got on the plane and I thought, now if they lose my ukulele, I have no audition, because, you know, I don't have characters. And they lost my ukulele. So then I got picked up and they took me to a hotel where the other girls who were against me were staying. There were about 10 other girls from Canada and Chicago. The next day they marched us all down the street in a row, like ducks, past that big guy Atlas holding the world. I wore my French maid costume from when I was a cigarette girl because that's when I started doing the stand-up thing. I was really nervous. We were all in the hallway waiting, and then everyone was whispering that one of the girls had done a strip routine for her audition. And that's a really dumb idea, I think, because you can't really be naked on NBC, you know? Even if you look good naked, it's not going to help a comedy program. So then I did my little stand-up comedy act. I guess I had about 10 minutes. I sang my songs and did my handstand poetry, and Lorne was watching with about 3 Lornettes. You know, they're called the Lornettes, the girls who work for Lorne and make sure he has plenty of popcorn. The bravest cast members would eat some of Lorne's popcorn, but I was scared too. But one time I did, and like one kernel fell on the floor, and one of the Lornettes gave me a dirty look. They're not supposed to let any of them fall on the floor, you see. So I did my audition, and then they said, oh, spend the night. Lorne wants to see you tomorrow, but he doesn't come in until 4 p.m. because he wakes up late and starts the workday at 3 p.m. Then he met with me, and he said, well, you, I loved your audition. It was really funny, but I don't know if you're really strong in character. And I said, oh, well, I could talk like this and be British. And he goes, yeah. And I go, I could talk like this, and that's a character. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, like if I wanted you to be Annie Hall, you know? And I said, well, then I would just wear men's clothing and kind of look at the ground a lot. And he goes, well, what if I wanted you to be a housewife in the Midwest? And I said, well, I am a housewife. So then I went home and I thought, oh man, I was so close, but he's not going to pick me. So I was supposed to be on Carson again in 2 weeks, and I thought, hey, what if I continue my audition on national TV? That would really impress Lorne. So I asked The Tonight Show, and they said, sure, but just don't say the name of the show. So I got all these tapes of people and tried to imitate them, like Tina Turner and Terry Garr and stuff. But it wasn't my strong point, you know? So I thought, well, if I just try to do the impression and people know who I'm doing and they laugh, well, all your goal is to make laughter, so it doesn't matter how you get there. So I sat next to Johnny Carson and I told him I was auditioning for a show and I had to do characters and I said, let me do them for you and if you can guess who I'm doing, then I'm doing it good, right? He goes, okay. So I went, ow, ow, ow! Archie, I'm sorry. And he goes, Edith Bunker. And I go, yeah. And the audience claps. And I go, I don't know why I'm here. Just go to a commercial. I don't have anything to say. I don't know why I'm here. And Johnny says, Terry Garr. And I go, yeah. And then I went, what's love got to do with it? Got to do with it. And I danced, you know? And he goes, Tina Turner. And I go, yeah. And so then I was smoking a cigarette, and he goes, I don't know, Betty Davis? And I go, no. And he goes, who is it? And I go, I made her up. And then Johnny laughed so hard. The audience laughed, too. And then he goes, if you made it up, how am I supposed to guess who it is? And I go, oh, I don't know. I'm supposed to make up characters in this show, you know? So then my manager at the time took the video of that show to Lauren's L.A. hotel in case he wasn't watching that night. And then, about a week later, they called me at home again. It was 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, and she goes, "Congratulations, you're in the cast of Saturday Night Live." And I was like, "Oh, thank you." And she goes, "There will be a ticket waiting for you at LAX in the morning, and we're putting you in a hotel until we find you an apartment." I was like, "Oh, thank you." So I hung up the phone and then I screamed really loud because I had been trying to act real cool in front of her. And then my baby woke up and started crying. And then my ex-husband, he doesn't handle pressure very well. He threw up on the bed.
Terry Turner. When we got there, Bonnie and I had been married for a bit. One thing good about us is we've always worked together, and she could shore me up, and I could shore her up, and we could yell at each other, too. We both went in for therapy during the show, so that might have helped. Wait, I can't believe I just said that. That Saturday night drove us both to therapy. I'd never thought about it until now. Bob Odenkirk, writer. They hired Robert Smigel as writer, and then while Robert wrote, I would sort of work with him on the phone every week and pitch him ideas and help him with his ideas. And meanwhile, I was continuing to write sketches in Chicago, and I would mail those in to Robert, and he'd pass them around the office, and sometimes they would do a joke of mine on Weekend Update. I think there was maybe even one sketch that I might have written that was done. And so people were kind of familiar with my work. And I came in and did an interview the following year, which was Robert's second year, and then I was hired a few months later. I interviewed with Lorne, which was extremely weird. I basically had a huge chip on my shoulder, and mix that in with Lorne's traditional intimidation that it's not good. I didn't respond to the way he likes to approach young performers and set himself up as some kind of very distant, strange comedy god. Kevin Nealon, cast member. When Aykroyd and those guys were on, the original years, I moved out to California to do stand-up, so I was always out there in the clubs when the show was on and didn't get to see it that much. I never really thought that was my gig. I didn't do characters or impressions. My stand-up was basically off the wall, absurd. I was influenced by Andy Kaufman and Albert Brooks and Steve Martin, you know? The clubs in 1975 were really tough. Audiences were really brash and heckling, and they're all crammed in these little rooms, and the comics were just tough New York guys, and there was a lot of profanity and heckling going on. And I remember seeing Larry David on stage one night follow some heckler right out into the street and slug it out with him. So I thought California would be a good place.
Victoria Jackson. Oh, another thing. In my audition, when Lauren said, "I think you're weak in characters," I said, "Oh, well, you know who's the greatest female character actress in America? Jan Hooks." And I didn't even know if he knew her, but I had already worked with her on the half-hour comedy hour, which was trying to be like SNL, and I was like a baby at the time. It was like my first TV show. Arsenio Hall was the star of it, and I had seen Jan be brilliant. Like, backstage when the cameras weren't even on, she would do a lesbian gas station attendant in Atlanta, and she would just go into these people, and I thought she was, like, great. I mean, personally, she pretty much hates my guts, but professionally, I thought she was, like, a genius. So I told Lorne, and I told her later, I told Lorne to hire you.
Kevin Nealon. I was renting a house in the Hollywood Hills, and Dana was living in an apartment over the garage, temporarily, and there was another comedian I was living with, and a writer, and I was dating Jan Hooks at the time.
Jan Hooks. Kevin was great. We were really, really good friends, and my mom got sick. My mom had cancer. And I just grabbed on to Kevin, and he went down to Atlanta where my mom was, and we just started this relationship. It was a relationship out of a kind of trauma, and the only problem was that we both got Saturday Night Live in the middle of it. He was hired as a featured player, and Lorne wasn't quite sure what I was. He thought the year before I was too old, and then I heard through the grapevine that he thought I had a weird mouth, and he didn't want to hire me because of my mouth.
Terry Turner.
Dana and Bonnie and I wrote a lot of the church ladies together, but it was Dana's creation. We sort of played support. We were the only people, because we were from the South and there was a cable industry in the South that hadn't quite reached into New York. We were the first people who really knew, next to Jan, who Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were, and all of the nuances of who they were, which is sort of how we got into the church lady, because it became a target of that character. And we were sort of the people who could access it quickly.
Jan Hooks. I knew Tammy Faye Baker from the 70s. She had a show in Atlanta when I worked in Atlanta. I would just religiously, pardon the pun, watch. It was just unbelievable. And I turned my friends on to Tammy Faye, and I actually went into Lorne and said that there's a woman that's on cable, Tammy Faye Baker, and I would really love to do her. He said, I've never heard of her. I said, yeah, but she's such a great character. And then, lo and behold, the scandal happened. Rosie Schuster, writer. Dana's audition tape was the most amazing audition tape I've ever seen, because he nailed impressions and pushed them to this surreal place. But he also did these amazingly absurd, highly original characters like the chopping broccoli guy. I especially responded to this rudimentary version of the church lady. The smug, superior attitude was there, and the consummately couchy, isn't that special? I think that character reminded me of a waspy, repressed side of Toronto that was very big on shaming. So I mentioned that to Lorne, and he teamed me up with Dana, who at the time was this sketch comedy virgin, and together we anchored this character in a church chat talk show format. And we added all this titillating talk of engorged naughty bits and all that kind of stuff. Church chat stole the rehearsal. And it got moved up to open the show, the first show of the new season. So it was pretty prominent, pretty scary. But it struck a main vein pretty instantly, instant franchise time, and they were very fun to write. The church lady would project her filthy, erotomaniac imagination all over the poor, hapless guest, whoever they were. She would basically verbally slime them with her own repressed garbage, and then she'd go to town shaming them. She had a black belt in shaming, and then she'd coyly suggest their behavior was the work of Satan. Thinking back, I think the church lady was the forerunner of what Kenneth Starr did to Bill Clinton.
Dana Carvey. The very first night was a crisis. The church lady, which no one knew if it would work, was going to be the last sketch on in the dress rehearsal right before the goodnights, in other words, the dumping ground. But then it killed in dress, and they moved it up to be the very first sketch. And then I had this chopping broccoli thing, and then the show was sort of on my shoulders for some reason, and I felt just intense pressure. I would essentially cry in my dressing room. I'm emotional. And then I was swearing at myself in the mirror. There was so much pressure because there I was, 31. I never thought I would get on Saturday Night Live, and here was this first show. I was unknown. I had never done sketch comedy. The red light was going to come on. 20 million people. The pressure was so extreme, at least the way I felt. And then it came off great. So that was a huge moment.
Jan Hooks. The show changed my life, obviously. But I have horrible stage fright. And with all these, you know, stand-up comics who I love, you know, Dana and Dennis and Kevin and all these people, you know they wanted their shot. They wanted to get in there and do it, but I was one of the ones that between dress and air was sitting in the corner going, please cut everything I'm in. Victoria Jackson. The first live show of my life, my ex-husband had a hemorrhoidectomy performed in the hospital on the day of my show, and he's like, why aren't you here visiting me? I'm like, I'm on Saturday Night Live! For my first time! Are you kidding? Jan Hooks. Victoria Jackson? I thought she had a pretty good gig. I just have a particular repulsion to grown women who talk like little girls. It's like, you're a grown woman. Use your lower register. And she's a born-again Christian. I don't know. She was like from Mars to me. I never really got her. Victoria Jackson. When we would sit in his office, we'd be on the floor and he'd be on the desk, like we were little preschool kids. From that sense, it's kind of fatherly. He would never say, "You did a great show last week." He would say, "Well, the show was okay. Do we have one this week?" So he didn't play favorites and he didn't compliment us too much. But I was used to that because my dad doesn't compliment me either. My dad was my gymnastics coach and he only said criticisms. I never gained weight because I was on my toes all the time. Sometimes I walked down the hall and he would say, "Hi, Victoria," and then the next time he would walk down the hall, I would say, "Hi, Lorne," and he'd completely ignore me. I was 1 inch away from him and he'd keep walking. It was a kind of scary, weird thing.
Dana Carvey. I'm too passive-aggressive to have ever had a fight with Lorne, but we had little snippets. You're working under conditions where you're exhausted. If I'd been assigned an impression that I didn't get and I just tanked at dress, he'd say, "Dana, are you ever going to get John Travolta?" Or whoever. "No, I'm never going to get it, Lorne. You should just cut it." "Really?" My thing was like, "Church lady's not happening tonight." And I would just say, "Well, maybe we should just cut it." "Right, so you're saying we're going to cut the thing that's going to make the show." "Well, that's my suggestion." "Dana, no, don't misunderstand me." Lorne is so brilliant at getting in your head. No, don't misunderstand me. I think it's fabulous. If you want to go that route, that burlesque route, it's fine. But I think you'll find if you keep it smart, it's where all the good stuff is. See, I had to learn all that, because I thought a laugh is a laugh. And then Lorne and those guys were kind of like, "Well, no, there's different levels. There's smart laughs and there's dumb laughs." Being a stand-up comedian to me, it was just, get the fucking laugh at all costs.
Victoria Jackson. I brought the writers food. They were all very intensely writing. Their goal wasn't to make me a star. Most of them wrote themselves into the show to become stars. If you want to get in the show more, you could always bring the writers some food. Well, I tried that. I asked Robert Smigel, "Robert, how come I never get to do any impressions? I never get to do any characters." And he says, "Because you're nasal." And I said, "There must be someone nasal I can do an impression of." He goes, "Roseanne Barr is kind of nasal." And I said, "Let me do her. She's hot now. She's nasal. Can I do her?" And he's like, And so he wrote a sketch, and I was thrilled. John Lovitz always tried to help me get in the show, too. Dana and Kevin and Lovitz, they helped a little. Kevin and Dana wrote me into Hans and Franz as Roseanne getting liposuction.
Kevin Nealon. I think Hans and Franz made Dana and me laugh more than any other characters when we were writing them. It's funny how something like that will permeate the culture and become pop culture. It seems audiences are like parrots. They like to repeat phrases that either have some kind of cadence to them or are silly. Whether it's, "Isn't that convenient?" or "We want to pump you up," or whatever it is. "Cheeseburger, cheeseburger." It's something that everybody can relate to when they get around at the office on Monday morning and just kind of laugh, because everybody kind of recognizes it. They can all be in on the laugh, and they can use it as their own little personal joke. I mean, I do that, too, with other people's stuff. If I hear a lot of Mike Myers stuff like, "Yeah, baby," I find myself doing that. People need that occasional catchphrase in their life. The coolest thing for Dana and me is that on the space shuttle, they were doing Hans and Franz, which was fun. John Lovitz. You're always competing. I mean, it's not like you want the other people to do bad. But it's just the way it's set up, because, you know, you write all Tuesday night, and then they pick like 3 of the 40 sketches at read-through, and then they whittle that down to 14 of them, then 6 would get cut. Only about 8 or 9 make it to air. It was competitive. I mean, it was just the way it worked. And when I was there anyway, it was almost like the writers against the cast. And if you got a lot of stuff on 1 week, the next week there'd hardly be anything written for you.
I also think that the writers would just write for themselves, really, a lot of times. And just whatever they happened to think of, that's what they thought of. So certain writers you ended up hooking up with because, you know, your humor was more like theirs. I worked a lot with A. Whitney Brown doing the liar character the first year, and then Al Franken would write for me a lot. When I was on the show, like, just say from 86 to 90, that group stayed the same for 4 years, you know, the eight of us. And it was very competitive, but everybody was working really, really hard and really wanted the sketches to be great. And also, I think our group was into saying, let's do this sketch, but also try to do great acting, like the best as actors, and play it really, you know, funny, but also trying to make it really real and believable. My first year, I was doing well, so they pushed me a lot, and I got everything on. And then my second year, I got less. Lorne said, you're going to have a lot of competition this year. And then, I don't know, I was supposed to do a liar movie, and it didn't work out. And so that caused problems between Lorne and me. So I would say stuff about him, and it would get back to him, because I was angry about it. So it would get tougher for me to get pieces on. And then, you know, he was mad at me. I mean, he just was. He was mad at me for the next 4 years. And then he was mad at me for leaving the show for 6 or 7 years. Because I left. What happened was, he was mad. I mean, everybody would talk about him, but for some reason, everything I said got back to him. I wasn't saying anything different than anybody else. I would never say it in public, and I still won't, because the guy hired me, you know, and he gave me the opportunity of a lifetime. So my beef with him was more about, I thought we were friends, and I heard he said stuff about me. So I was hurt by that. I was supposed to do 2 movies that summer and then come back to the show. So I was just thrilled, you know? And then one of the movies didn't happen. And the other movie, I would have had to miss 2 shows to do it. And Lorne said, you can't miss shows. So I had to choose. Personally, I didn't think it was fair, because my contract was up, and I thought, you know, I did a really good job for 5 years, and I just asked him to miss the first 2 shows. But his opinion was, well, you know, this show is really important. If I let you miss shows, I have to let everybody else miss shows, and, you know, Belushi and Aykroyd do movies and fly back and forth. And so I asked the producer, could I do that? And he said, we can't. You can't do that. It wouldn't work out. Lorne was getting a lot of pressure, too, from NBC executives who didn't like, especially Ohlmeyer, didn't like the idea of people running off to make movies, which to me was stupid. I'd say, look, I'll miss the first 2 shows, and then you don't have to pay me, of course, or I'll make them up. If he'd said, you can do the show, but if you get movies, you can do those too, I would have said, fine, sign me up for the next 5 years. Because then what you would have had, from my point of view, is a cast full of movie stars. Wouldn't that have been something? Of course, Lorne later admitted it was a mistake, and he should have done it that way. And then the following year, he let people miss shows. So, you know, for me personally, it's kind of upsetting, because I really wanted to stay. And then, of course, the movie I did came out for a week. It was a colossal bomb. It was called Mom and Dad Save the World. What happened was, they re-edited the movie for kids, so if it had any edgy humor, they took it out, you know? After the 5th year, when my manager said, why don't you just clear the air with him? He was very angry. I went in there to do that with him, and he was very angry with me. He was shaking. He was furious. Not yelling, but just shaking, you know? But after that, we cleared it, and I said, okay. I think a lot of the problem that people have with Lorne is that they just know him as the genius from Saturday Night Live, right? Oh, he's picked you to be in his show. So it's the opportunity of a lifetime. So you're grateful to the guy, you know, like here's this guy giving you the chance of a lifetime. So you're automatically like, thank you. And he's the boss, and you have strong feelings for him, and you want to please your boss. And, you know, he's not really demonstrative that way. But actors are. Many writers got their starts, or their first major professional gigs, on Saturday Night Live, and then went on to write sitcoms or movies, hits and flops. The show truly was a talent processing plant, and the most influential comedy academy in TV history. Among those who went through the process was a young, tall Irish-American with skin as fair as Snow White's. Conan O'Brien, writer. I was always a nervous Saturday Night Live writer. I found being a writer on Saturday Night Live more nerve-wracking than being the host of Late Night and replacing Letterman. Greg Daniels, writer. Conan O'Brien and I were a writing team at one point on this HBO show called Not Necessarily the News, and we did a packet of material for Saturday Night Live, and then we didn't really hear anything for about a year. And in the intervening time, we had gone on to a different show, and then that show had failed. We had an interview with Lorne. I remember when we went into the interview, he offered us wine, and we said no, and then he asked us some question, like, "How do I know you'll succeed here at the show?" And we said, "You don't. We might not." So we left the interview, and Jim Downey, who was the guy that had brought us in, came up to us and said, "How can you answer questions like that? It was terrible." Eventually, I don't know why, we ended up getting the job. I think that they had said about 10 minutes later that it was okay. This was more like big-time showbiz stuff, and we didn't really know the rules of that kind of behavior, so we were still kind of rubes. I think we should have accepted the wine at least.